Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Anchorage Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Rebecca Braun of the Alaska Budget Report, Tim Bradner of the Alaska Journal of Commerce, and Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News. The Alaska legislature is dead in the water. Rebecca, you're on the scene in Juneau. Tell us what is or what is not happening today and over the last few days.
Well, actually, I think I'm off the scene today being in Juneau since the action has moved to Anchorage. Really, there's more rhetoric than anything else. Legislators passed the sort of easy bills on the special session call last week, and now they're just stuck where they were at the end of session. And instead of talking to each other, it seems right now the governor and the Senate in particular are speaking to each other through press conferences, and it's getting increasingly toxic.
How did we get where we are?
Well, it's a good question. I think it goes back to the governor's sort of linking passage of the oil tax and the budget. He said earlier that if his oil tax reduction doesn't go through the Senate, he'll have to make vetoes because he'll have to save more money for the future, his logic being that oil production will decline. Senators disagree with that logic, and they did not pass the oil tax bill, and now they say they're concerned he'll be vindictive with his vetoes. So they tried to put language in that says you can't veto any of these $400 million in energy projects, and some of them, of course, are the governor's priorities and the House priorities, or all of them will go. So the governor and the House has stood by him, is saying that language is unconstitutional, infringes on the governor's right to his line item veto. And so they're just stuck because the Senate is refusing to send the capital budget to the House without some kind of agreement. And we've been at this impasse for a couple weeks now.
And what would be required for the end game? Just what you described, there's some kind of agreement on the budget language. Could that do it?
Well, that's a good question. I initially thought it was quite simple and that all that would need to happen would be that the governor would need to say, look, Senate, I understand how you're feeling here, and I give you my word that I won't, you know, use my budget veto vindictively. I'll do a professional vetting, and I invite you to look at my logic, you know, please trust me on that, and that the Senate could look him in the eye and say, okay, they could sort of save face, we'll remove this language, and we're going to hold you to it, and everybody would be happy. But I kind of realize now that that assumes that everybody actually wants a win-win. And after the rhetoric I've heard this week, I think there's a lot of animosity toward the Senate, and some of it directed really at Bert Stedman personally, the Senate Finance Co-Chair, and that the House and Senate, the House and the governor don't necessarily want to help the Senate save face and find a winning solution.
That's very interesting. Tim, you have seen many legislative sessions. How do you explain this one?
It's really hard. What Rebecca just described is just a train wreck that's happening, I think. You have to go back a long ways to see anything like quite like this. We have seen end of sessions dragging out like this years ago before there actually was a 120-day session. So standoffs and empty hallways and people hiding out back in offices cutting deals was really...
And the troopers at one point out looking for people.
Yeah, I mean, those things happen. But I guess I've never seen it get quite so low as it is now. The standard of rhetoric... posturing press conferences, dueling legal opinions, interpreting the same Superior Court decision.
Totally differently.
Yeah, just totally, I just haven't seen it quite is this low.
And Steve McDonald, where's our old friend public opinion?
Well, I haven't seen any polls per se. I've been kind of reading the comments posted on websites, our website, ktuu.com, ADN, those places. And I think everybody's getting slimed in this pretty good. You know, the House, the Senate, and certainly the governor is getting his just due in this as well. And it appears that everybody's dug their heels in at this particular point in time, and no one's willing to bargain. There was a letter released yesterday by the Democrats in the House. I think a little bit of posturing on their part, but they said with a 3-point plan to get everybody out of this mess. But again, it would require, as Rebecca was talking about, for folks to sit down and look each other in the eye and compromise. And I don't know if that's possible right now. I think right now, maybe the best thing for everybody to do is just adjourn. And take a little cooling off period and then come back later on. But
now, Tim, you went to downtown Anchorage on Friday and saw the House holding its, the House Finance Committee holding its hearing. What did you see?
Well, I think the meeting was sort of symbolic and, you know, a fair amount of posturing. It was the opportunity for the House Finance Committee majority members to use the meeting to bolster their position that the governor should not, the Senate should not package all these projects together. And they had people there, like they had Dan Fowsky of Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and Sarah Fisher Goad of the Alaska Energy Authority. And they were questioning them on popular projects that were bundled in with all the other energy projects, that if they all felt this, it would be such a terrible thing that all these popular projects like home weatherization, the rebate program, would also fail. So sit in a dam, things like that. So, you know, those people who were on the hot seat danced around it as best they could, but it was really a political exercise. On the other side of it, Representative Les Guerra was there representing the Democrats, and he was defending somewhat the Senate, and it was interesting, the strange bedfellows that all this makes.
Let's go back to Rebecca and Juno. Rebecca, what are the implications for next year and especially for Governor Parnell's tax revisions?
Well, that's a good question because actually it was out of the picture. The governor, I think to his credit, did not put it on the special session call. He knew that that would just really mire everybody in muck. They're mired nonetheless. And then I think yesterday things took a little bit of a turn for the worse when the Senate announced that they were going to have a hearing today on ACEs, the current tax, basically highlighting the successes of ACEs with invited testimony only. And it was sort of a response to the House's political theater, which is what the Senate considers it today. So I think it doesn't bode well just for the rhetoric around that, for the debate around the oil tax bill next year, assuming it's back next year and not before then. And we'll see how that goes. But, you know, just thinking about the causes of this current impasse, I think it goes back sort of further and deeper than just the governor's threat. And in part, I think that Lyman Hoffman and Stedman, Bert Stedman, who are from sort of rural areas, Stedman's from Sitka, Southeast, and Lyman Hoffman from Bethel, those are areas that are going to lose power in redistricting, no matter how the maps are drawn. It's inevitable that you know, Southeast and rural Alaska have lost population. And I think those guys are smart, and they know this is the end of the coalition in which they wield so much power, and this is their last chance to ensure that some of these projects they feel very, very strongly about to get them funded. And so I think that is why they feel so strongly about these energy projects in particular and this capital budget that so many see as bloated. They see it as their last chance.
Okay, thank you. Tim Bradner, you had something you wanted to add?
Well, the feeling I got this morning in listening to the House Finance Committee discussion is that there was just a lot of irritation among the House members that they didn't have their projects in the Senate budget. There was a lot of suspicion about where do these projects come from, how much. The focus of most of the hearing was how much vetting have these projects had, who's looked at them, who scrutinized them. Mm-hmm. And the AEA people talked about where they came from. A lot of them, in fact, have been reviewed.
I think this would be, excuse me if I might, very difficult for the bureaucrats who came up or executives that came up there to testify because they don't want to have to take sides in this war between the House and the Senate. They want to be everybody's friend, right?
It was very difficult. And both of them, all the people who were there, Dan Fowsky, Sarah, Peter Krimp of AEA, handled it very gracefully. The legislators were not so graceful.
Maybe we can watch some of that on Channel 2 Friday and Saturday. Steve McDonald, how does television cover an event An event,
yeah.
A post-legislative special session in which there are no floor sessions, there are no committee hearings, or I guess I can't say no.
Right,
they're
rare
and infrequent,
right.
And that essentially what we got is press conferences
and
letters.
If this tells the story, our Juno crew drove in, got back into the newsroom here in Anchorage Thursday night at about 5:30, 6 o'clock, so we brought them home. It is difficult to cover something that's, you know, it's not really happening right now, right?
Somebody comes out of a room and reads a letter.
That's about it. And so what we're doing is, you know, we've been down there every day of the session. We've had Ted Land, Carolyn Hall, our photographer. They've been down there covering this day by day, and they've done a great job. So we just decided, well, let's bring them back right now because things are so sporadic. I don't know how this is going to – this could be dragging on for months or for weeks, certainly – you know, into next week now, it looks like, at the very least. So we'll keep an eye on it. And gavel to gavel, I know we'll be watching gavel to gavel and calling our sources just to see if there is any movement down there.
Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Rebecca Braun, Tim Bradner, and Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News. Tim, we know what the legislature didn't do in the way of oil and oil policy this year, but what did the legislature do with other oil and gas legislation?
Well, there wasn't really, everything was bound up in House Bill 110. The governor had proposed enhancing some tax credits. I think one thing that is, there's a significant, this has a relationship to oil and gas, there's a significant sideshow going on involving coastal management. And this is the effort to rewrite.
Why don't you take a moment to tell us about that, please?
Well, coastal management is a process where rural communities can be consulted by state agencies and federal agencies, and it ties into the Federal Coastal Management Act. The state has signed onto that. We have a law that's been on the books. We have a program that links rural communities into a network of being able to comment and have their input. And a few years ago, Governor Murkowski reorganized the program and brought it more under state control. The rural communities have bristled under that, and they've been, starting last year, they've been wanting to reassert their, you know, their influence. The program is up for reauthorization. If a bill doesn't pass, the program ends July 1. A lot of efforts behind the scenes and on the scene have gone into restructuring. There's a bill before Senate Finance Committee which would do that. There's some, the Senate Finance Committee, it's one of the issues that's on the plate during the special session. There's a concern that rural legislators still want to have more changes in it. The oil companies and resource companies are very concerned about problems this might create for permitting systems. So that's very much in play. And I think there's surely a linkage between that and the capital budget and other things that are going on.
And what would it take to get that passed?
Oh, that would take the Senate doing some amendments to what the House passed and send it back to the House. It's a fairly simple procedure, but whether that happens or not, it's down in the mire, down in the muck with all the rest of these things.
Is it possible to just get buried in all the confusion and charges and countercharges and so
forth? And if it doesn't pass, the program just ends. And that means that there are many who feel, well, so what? But it does mean that rural communities won't have a say, have a vehicle to have a say in permitting issues and things like that.
Rebecca, I have a question for you. It's a little bit of history, but it's recent history. When this session of the legislature convened in Juneau, what did Mike Chenault, the Speaker of the House, and President Stevens of the Senate, and the governor say they were going to do, and how does that compare with what they did?
It's funny you should ask, because this year I was keenly aware early on that nobody really outlined a very aggressive agenda or vision. So in a sense, they accomplished exactly what they set out to accomplish, which is very little. And that sounds a little harsh, but to give them credit, Mike Chenault has always been one who says, well, if we pass any bills, we should just strike some laws that we have on the books, not make more. So in a sense, that's his idea of being a conservative. The governor, his highest priorities clearly were the oil tax bill, and we all know that that did not pass, at least not yet. And another major priority of his was to pass a funding vehicle, basically, a bill that would set up an ongoing fund source for his merit scholarship program. And that was important enough to him that he put it on the special session call. And it's probably dead in the water. The House passed it, and it's in the Senate where they are showing no interest in passing it. And that's sort of a philosophical difference. The Senate would prefer to see more needs-based scholarship aid. So, you know, the governor is probably smarting a bit because those are probably his two biggest priorities, and they both got stuck in the Senate. As far as the House and the Senate, they really didn't outline a very aggressive agenda. For the Senate, I think it's what they would call a robust capital budget, what other people might call a forked-up capital budget.
Okay. And Mike Schneld is emerging as a really important player here as the Speaker of the House. A lot of people really don't know him very well, here in Anchorage in particular. How would you describe his style, his approach to leadership, and is he just stuck in the middle of this mess? Is that without, I mean, does he feel that I didn't ask for any of this?
Yeah, I think so. Mike is sort of a great guy. I mean, he's kind of a good old boy type. He's from the oil industry, sports services, from Kenai. He's done a really good job. This is his second, I guess it must be his third year as speaker. The Democrats feel he's fair, that he's pretty conservative, but that process-wise, he's fair. And I had thought that he might play a role in helping to broker a deal between the governor and the Senate. And I suggested that to him earlier this week. And his response convinced me that he's not really interested in that, that he's pretty angry at the Senate. So I don't think that he's wanting to help the Senate find a way out or save face or get to a win-win solution.
We're going to come back to Tim in just a second, but I had one other question for you, Rebecca. Down here we are in Anchorage. It's pretty hard to know who Governor Parnell relies on for advice in this difficult political battle. Do you have a sense, is there anybody or any buddies emerging as the people Parnell goes to talk to when he's trying to formulate responses and presumably come to some kind of agreement here, or at least an end?
You know, that's not entirely clear. He kept on Mike Nizek as his chief of staff. He was Palin's chief of staff, and who's actually was on the staff of Governor Murkowski, Governor Knowles, so I'm not sure that he's so much of a soulmate for him. His new attorney general is somebody he goes way back with and seems to be somebody he's relying on and has a lot of confidence in. But it's not entirely clear to me where he's getting his advising. And in fact, some people who are not happy with what he's doing are suggesting that he's not getting any advising or not getting any good advising.
Okay, and that Attorney General is John Burns of Fairbanks. Tim, you had a thought here, and then I got a question for you.
Oh, just a quick addition to what Rebecca said a minute ago. The one of the reasons for the irritation of the House and Senate is also that the House majority, at least, was pretty much invested in the oil tax. They passed it. They took a lot of heat. It was not a big margin it passed, but they were right there with the governor in wanting the Senate to work on the oil tax. So that I think has contributed to this.
And that happens every time the legislature makes a decision that's difficult and in some places unpopular, and then the bill dies in the other House where people haven't taken a vote. Steve, you had a thought here?
No, I wondered too, and maybe for Tim and for Rebecca too, how much of this is the Governor Parnell's first legislative session as an elected governor. I wonder how much of this is related to perhaps some rookie mistakes, just not having that experience of being at the helm going through a legislative session. He did it as acting or as interim, but I just wonder how much of this may be just some rookie mistakes on his part.
Well, I think you could call some of this that. Mm-hmm. He's still learning this business of being governor, mm-hmm. and this is, of course, a very difficult situation he's in. Mm-hmm. However, we do know he's very stubborn from his years in the Senate, and those of us who've known him, mm-hmm. he has a stubborn streak about him, and I think this is coming out.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca, one thing that struck me is the governor's biggest problems, well, they're not completely, but to a significant degree are with Republicans in the Senate. And so the governor's warring with them, and the senators are unhappy. But they were unhappy with Sarah Palin, many legislators were. And they were unhappy with Frank Murkowski. And then before that, they were unhappy with Tony Knowles. Is it a legislator's lot to be unhappy with the governor?
You know, maybe in some senses it is. And this Senate, you know, it's so personality driven. And right now, although Gary Stevens is the Senate president, he's sort of a good mediator, moderating force. He's not so much at the ideological helm. I would say the people really driving that train are Senator Hoffman and Senator Stedman, who are the co-chairs of finance. And as I said before, I think they just feel a very strong imperative to get their agenda through before they lose power. And they also, just temperamentally, both of them, enjoy the game. I think that they see politics as a lot of gamesmanship, and what the House and the governor see as really just shoving policy down others' throats through unscrupulous means, they see as part of the political game.
There's no question about it. Sean Parnell sees himself as a moral actor in these matters. I think that just from what he says and the way he carries himself, that's the case.
I think it's true. And one more thing is that, you know, he's really been smeared with the Captain Zero label and all kinds of other unsavory names, especially in relation to Sarah Palin. And this may be an opportunity he sees to assert himself, and maybe he sees compromise right now as a sign of weakness.
Right. Tim, ConocoPhillips just announced its profits for the first quarter of this year. They were included $549 million in Alaska. That's for one quarter. Are the company's profits going to be part of the debate, or an increasing part of the debate, on revising the oil taxes?
Oh, they will. And I think what you're seeing already is that people are interpreting those numbers. Both sides are interpreting those numbers the way they want to. One side
My says, favorite being, yeah, $549 million is not as big as it looks.
Well, I think the first quarter for the year previous was something like $516 million. So what the people who are for oil tax reform argue is that the profit is not up. It's only up. It's not up nearly as much as oil prices are. So the point they make is that the company did not get as much gain as it should have out of the oil price increase, and that's because of the taxes. Mm. And of course, the other side of other people argue, well, look at all those profits those guys are making. Yeah, so bad word, profits.
Yeah. Yeah. Steve, turning to Anchorage, and this is Anchorage Edition, and we have a police officer who wasn't a citizen. Tell us about that, and how does that happen?
That's a good question, and I think the police department is trying to find that out right now. They're reviewing it, their processes and things like that, to determine what it can do better screening applicants and officers. But it was last Friday, a week from the day here we're recording, the U.S. Attorney's Office and APD Chief Mark Mew announced that one of the officers on the force, is known as Rafael Espinoza, is actually Rafael Mora Lopez. And they found this discrepancy when Lopez was trying to reapply for a passport. He's been fired from his job. He'd spent 6 years on the Anchorage Police Force. By all counts, he was a good officer. He's been charged now with one count of passport fraud, by the U.S. Attorney's Office. He's been living in the Anchorage area since the 1980s. And as I said, he's a six-year police vet. And it's unusual because we hear about how hard it is to become an Anchorage police officer. They have very hard, high, rigorous standards to meet. There are police officers, when we saw the economic downturn in the lower 48, there were a number of police officers who were laid off in cities like Cleveland, Detroit, and New
York. Just for example.
Right, and there were APD sent recruiters down to see if they could bring some of these veteran experienced police officers from other cities, and there were quite a few of them that washed out, just didn't meet the requirements. We've always had in this town very high requirements for
and
APD.
I think the department would be enthusiastic about a skilled, able Hispanic who could offer his experience, bilingual, undoubtedly.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And we have sticking with law enforcement, yeah. Steve, Judge John Sedgwick throws out the evidence in a pot case, and the evidence was a lot of pot, and the police department said they obtained what amounts to probable cause because the police officer could smell the dope.
Right, yeah, as you so well put it, didn't pass the smell test.
But it didn't pass the smell test.
Right, right. It was an Alaska State Trooper up in the Matsu Valley, and it was earlier this year, I believe, he was about 450 feet away from a home that he suspected to be a drug operation, and he maintains that he could smell the aroma of cultivated marijuana. So he used that to get a search warrant, and lo and behold, they found plenty of marijuana and other evidence of money laundering, things like that. So these two folks, it was a couple of the Toms, I believe, their last name, they were arrested. The case, much of the evidence was tossed out because the judge, Judge Sedgwick, just didn't believe that this trooper.
And Rex Butler, the defense attorney, hired an expert from Pennsylvania for a gigantic sum of money.
That's right. And it was all supposed to be in this shed, this alleged operation is supposed to be in this shed. No windows, everything sealed. There was this heavy-duty charcoal filter that filtered out any smell. So this operation, this shed was pretty well equipped anyways to handle, it seems like, all aspects of this operation. So the judge basically said, I don't think you could have done this. I don't think you could have smelled this. So a lot of this evidence has been tossed out now.
And the police officer took great umbrage at his ability to smell things being questioned.
You know, the guy's been a trooper for a long time, and he's got a lot of busts to his credit.
Thank you very much for joining us. We're about out of time. We want to especially thank Rebecca Braun for joining us from Juneau. And we'll be back next week in our new incarnation as Alaska Edition. See you next week.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org. Or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.